There's all sorts of ways to listen to BCFM Radio. Online at bcfmradio.com. On our free-to-download app from your app store. On digital, just search for BCFM on your DAB radio. Across the city on 93.2 FM. And now on smart speaker, just ask yours to play BCFM Radio. Your award-winning community radio station for Bristol. Online, on app, on digital radio, on smart speaker, and all over Bristol on 93.2 FM.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
Oh yes, boys and girls, we're back. We're going to be discussing plenty more in the second hour of this week's Politics Show. My name is Billy Quain, deputising for Tony Gosling, who's on a marvellous holly haul for himself somewhere exotic. Martin Summers and I are going to be setting the world to rights. Not really, we're just going to analyse some of the news stories you may not be fully apprised of this week. Asal Shah, Labour councillor for Easton, has granted us an extra 5 minutes because Tim Kent rather monopolised things before the news at seven. We may even draw him on Politics International. Who knows? Afzal Shah, welcome back. Thank you for staying with us for a little while longer. I realise you're a busy man, and it is Friday evening for you as well. What are you, first of all, your responses to Tim Kent's evasive analysis of Metrobus?
Well, it was good to actually listen to him, and he was digging a very deep hole for himself. But I do respect anyone who's prepared to put their hands up, and he did say that he takes a degree of responsibility for the mess that has been caused by Metrobus. And like you said, James Freeman, the MD, has actually said himself that the service is, well, it's not really fit for purpose, is it?
I mean, that's really damning. When the boss of the bus company says, this service that I've been dragging myself over hot coals to try and optimise for a year is still rubbish, after nearly £300 million has been spent on it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is down to historic decision-making and historic planning. And I just, what I was saying to Tim, that we've completely lost out in this area. People can't benefit from the Metrobus at all in terms of being picked up, dropped off in this area at all. So a lot of residents here, rightly so, feel that it's their tax money that has helped to subsidise that, to actually fund it, but they're not able to use it. And it's a real shame. And it's late, and as we're aware, when you go to just the outskirts of Bristol, Gypsy Patch Lane, where a lot of people actually commute to that area. You've got huge businesses up there, Rolls-Royce, British Aerospace, MOD, and many others. That's going to be closed for 8 months.
Yeah.
8 months of the year. I mean, that is just...
But part of Tim Kent's rationale for getting Metrobus in the first place was to get the neets, the not in education, employment or training from South Bristol, to the well-paid engineering jobs up at Filton. It has patently failed.
It has failed. And when we look at the eye-watering sums of money involved, one thinks that we could have put that to good use. And this is why, although you may question why, but that's why, if we can start having the conversation now and look at some of the viability tests in terms of potentially planning ahead for a mass transit system that connects up not only Bristol but the region. This is the time to actually do it. Yeah. You have to start planning ahead.
We've had the mass transit system and it hasn't worked. I mean, you sit on the planning committee. Let's take that hat off for a second. You also work day to day in transport in the city. I mean, you must be dreading going to work every morning. It's chaos. Yeah.
There are challenges in Bristol, but again, we do need to look forward in terms of planning. I mean, we can't look at this in isolation. Bristol has over 300 deaths because of very bad pollution. So I think it's important that we start planning ahead. Yes, it is going to cost money, but we need that vision, and it's about connectivity. And you can't put people, you can't just use a stick approach. You need a carrot and a stick. And that's why a mass transit system that is affordable, that is clean, that will, I hope, get people out of their own cars using a good, reliable transport system. I mean, it's great. Whenever I go to a place like Sheffield or Manchester, you get on the tram. It's great. I mean, you know, trams are...
We had an option for a tram before Metrobus was pushed through.
You know, they zero emissions because they're electric and cars can drive over them as well. And if you want to implement a congestion zone for the dirtiest of vehicles, then you can do that. But at least you've got a viable transport system. And that's why it is very important that we start looking at something now. You know, for the sake of our children, we do need a transport system for Bristol's future.
75% of the businesses in the centre of town are begging you not to push through this polluting vehicle tax. These are the businesses that are paying the majority of their commercial rates to the council. There is a lot of revenue here. By pushing through this legislation, they are afeared that they will be forced to shut because custom will desert them in favour of going to the Mall or going to other out-of-towns.
I have spoken to offices in the transport department, and they have made it very clear that there will be significant mitigation to ensure that businesses do have a level of protection. And there has to be a balance here, that if a business does have a Euro 6 vehicle, then as far as I understand, they may not have to actually pay a congestion charge.
Okay, so it's changing again.
So there is significant mitigation, and it's very important that we do listen to the businesses, especially small businesses. That's where a lot of people work, and like you said, they pay a lot of business rates, and we want the centre to be thriving. So we don't want to be a ghost town.
Let's talk about Bristol Energy. How much is it going to cost this year?
I really don't know. I can't plug... So I can't pluck a figure out of thin air.
Okay.
I can certainly get back to you.
Do you know how much it's going to cost next year?
I actually have my iPad with me.
Okay, we have time.
But I can actually get back to you.
How much it's already cost?
Millions.
How many millions?
Many millions.
Okay, and how many of those millions have come from central government?
As I said, for fear of giving the wrong information here, I would be happy to get back to you, more than happy to email you after I've clarified that. But what I would say is that it's also in giving residents the opportunity to actually look at their costs for gas and electricity. There's a massive challenge around fuel poverty, and if it can help save people money, I think that's a great thing in itself, especially for the more vulnerable in society, especially those on benefits and the OAPs, especially pensioners do actually need to have those savings too. So I think we need to look at the bigger picture, and also they do have a commitment to use clean energy. So in terms of in terms of sustainable forms of energy and fuel. We are pushing for that. There is a cost. I know that the cabinet member Craig, I've spoken to him about this. They're very serious about making sure that that Bristol Energy is self-sufficient financially.
How many solar panels have Bristol Energy or the council installed on the roof of council-owned properties in the last 5 years?
I honestly do not know.
Because
but
that
I can
is,
find out for you.
You can manufacture these things locally with the high-end, developing high-end manufacturing jobs in the south of the city where they don't need to travel to Filton to get these jobs. And it is, as we are aware for now, the greenest form of energy available.
Turbines, yeah, turbines as well, PV solar panelling. I think it's very important that we continue to invest in them. And I would also ask that the Metro Mayor uses some of the money at his disposal to make sure that, we invest in this as well, in the city and in the region, so that if we are building this kind of technology, that it can be rolled out very quickly and utilised by, local businesses.
Well, all of these council-owned properties have roofs, many of which face in the correct direction. Mm. Surely this is something that should have been a work in progress for the last 5 years.
Perhaps it's happening. So I think it's very important that that I follow this up.
Well, surely if it was happening, you would be delighted to tell me at how well it's going.
I mean, as you can imagine, there's... the council business extends to many different facets, and myself, just as a humble local councillor, that it's perhaps is something that, I need to actually go and look into, and then more than happy to get back to you.
Okay,
so I'm more than happy to send you an email next week.
I relish the arrival of that email.
But I would say, it was in this very building several years ago, about 5 years ago, that I held the. The managing director of Bristol Energy to account, Bill Edrich, and the former mayor, George Ferguson. There are things that, we could have done better, but I think that the administration that we have is really getting a grip on things, and environmental sustainability is one of those priorities.
Okay, a quick couple of quick ones left for you. I know that you have a keen interest in what's happening currently in Southeast Asia, because there is bloodletting in Mumbai because of Narendra Modi's new policy regarding Muslims getting citizenship in India. This is a hot topic.
Absolutely. I mean, this is populism. This is a case of selling fear to the masses about the other, and saying that actually Muslims are the fifth columnists, and they are the biggest threat. And it's a real shame, actually, what's happening in India. We had Trump recently visit India. He was asked about the killings and the mobs rampaging through Delhi and killing innocent Muslims, and he said, "Oh, I am aware of it," and he would not comment further. And Narendra Modi, this is somebody after the 2002 riots. Yeah, the 2002 riots in Gujarat, where thousands and thousands of, Muslims were actually killed. He was designated as a war criminal. He was actually stopped from flying into the major capitals of the West, Washington, London, Paris. And then fast forward a decade later, when he became the Prime Minister of India, he's welcomed with open arms, simply because money talks, and because all the leaders of the countries such as America, Canada, France and Britain and Germany, they want market liberalisation so that they can go and sell their goods and services in India. So it's all about money. It's an absolute shame. It's very divisive. He is an absolute fascist, He's got blood on his hands, and we should not forget that Kashmir, for over 200 days, over 200 days now, Kashmir has been in lockdown.
Well, they switched off the internet, and mobile phone transmission is no longer available.
Absolutely. So what is it that they're fearing, and what they're worried about is that, you know, people actually start speaking up and demanding their rights. And in terms of what's going on in India, it's essentially that Modi wishes to play divisive politics with Muslims. So what he's saying is that neighbouring countries such as Bangladesh and Pakistan and Afghanistan, which interestingly has no border with India at all, that if you're a minority, if you're a minority and you wish to seek asylum, you can do so as long as you are not Muslim.
Okay.
As long as you are not Muslim, yeah, because obviously Muslims need to be treated as third-class citizens in India. And really, Modi's battle is a battle about getting won over Islam. They detest the fact that they had the Mughal rulers in India, and they had the sultans before that. But they forget that, you know, a lot of great things were actually done. I mean, you can look at the work done by the Mughal emperor Akbar, who ensured that there was rights and freedoms for all communities, and he actually promoted specifically people from the Hindu community into his, what you would call in this day and age, cabinet. Mm. And in fact, if you look at the Taj Mahal, you look at the Red Fort and Aligarh University, you know, Muslims have made an incredible contribution to India. But he wishes to actually wash that away, just as we had the Spanish Inquisition, and the role of Muslims was actually washed away in Spanish school textbooks. They're doing the same thing. We're seeing exactly the same thing in India. They wish to get rid of Urdu as well, because they say, oh, this is a language that Muslims use. We want nothing to do with it.
How responsible should Britain feel for this? Because Mountbatten went in, 6 weeks' work, drew a couple of lines in the sand. In the following 12 months, 12 million people died. No, sorry, 120 million people displaced, 1 million people dead. Britain has that. Whatever blood you feel Modi has on his hands, Britain has 100 times that blood, surely.
Britain does, yeah. Britain's got a lot to answer for. But going back to Modi again, I think that if you look at Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who fought for the two-nation policy, saying that Muslims need a separate homeland because they did not feel safe in India. Well, he's been vindicated. I mean, you know, Muslims in India now, they are treated not as second, but third-class citizens. That is a fact, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's Kashmir, whether it's in after the killings in Gujarat, the killings in Mumbai, the killings now in Delhi. If you're a Muslim, India is not a safe place. And thank God that Muhammad Ali Jinnah did actually fight for Pakistan. Yes, Pakistan has its faults. Absolutely, it does. But at least, by and large, Muslims do feel safe there. But it wasn't just a country created for Muslims. If you look at the flag, it's green and white. The white was for the minorities, right? And the green is for Muslims. So in the sense that, you know, it's there for everybody. It was initially created for Muslims, but minorities, whether you're someone who adheres to any other faith or none, you have as much right to be a citizen of Pakistan and enjoy the rights and freedoms there. I think Britain has got a lot of soft power. I mean, we know DFID has got a budget of millions. And I think we need to be very mindful of how we spend that money. And I also think we should not be showcasing Modi unnecessarily. But of course, Boris Johnson, he is seeking to have a trade agreement with India. And he will go out of his way to turn a blind eye to all the killings. In fact, the shameful Jacob Rees-Mogg, when he was asked in Parliament by Khalid Mahmood MP just last week, about the concerns raised with the killings of people in Delhi. He said, yes, we are aware that Christian minorities may be under threat, and maybe other minorities, we are aware. And that was it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just not interested. Money talks.
Are you observing any kind of hostility here in Britain from Hindu communities?
Oh, absolutely not. So I think, yeah, we need to be perfectly clear. Bristol's only Hindu temple, and that's a very, very good question, Billy, and I'm glad you asked that, is a stone's throw away from here. It's in my ward, just on Church Road. It's the Hindu temple. We have excellent relations with them. I think very important to bear in mind that people in this country, whether you're Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, Christian, or of no faith, that people understand that everybody despises hostility and any infringement of human rights. And we're very keen to make sure that communities in this country understand the wider picture. So I think education really is important about what's going on there. And that's why we have to be very careful. There was a report recently, and I think Martin will probably have knowledge of this, that there are hundreds and hundreds of fake Indian websites pumping out fake news. Sorry to use the term fake news. I know that it's a term trumpeted by Trump himself.
Mm-hmm.
But we are very well aware of this. But it's very dangerous. You know, the wrong information, a little bit of information can actually do a lot of damage. And I think it's very important to people. Everybody needs to unite against fascism. And I think people just need to be mindful that ultimately humanity has to come first.
That's a very nice point for us to finish. Afzal Shah, thank you for your time this evening. Are you going to run for re-election in May?
Yes, I am. One more term, and that will have to be it, because after that, got to focus on the children. I mean, obviously, I'm focusing on the children already, but it's just when they get a bit older, I think, that my absolute focus has to be on them as a priority.
Very final. Are you optimistic for the future of Bristol?
Yes, I am. Do we have challenges? Yes, we do. We had Greta Thunberg here just last week.
Oh, yes, the grass grew back. Did you notice?
Yes, it did. Absolutely. Funny enough. I mean, it's actually very resilient. People play rugby on grass. They play cricket. They play football. They do many things on grass, and it does actually grow back. but it's the fact that she chose to actually come to Bristol. I think that was very, very telling. But yes, I am hopeful. But we've got a lot of challenges. And I think it's very important that people forget playing divisive politics and we unite for the betterment of the city. And I do feel that we've got a very and I mean this, I think that we've got a good, sincere administration in Bristol that is really keen to actually tackle the inequalities, the inherent systemic inequalities in this city. And in fact, before I go, I'll just say that just 2 days ago, we had the launch of the Faith Manifesto, the Mayor's Faith Manifesto, in terms of aspirations of tackling, helping raise awareness and tackling climate change, building sustainable neighbourhoods, strengthening the local communities, looking at the challenge of homelessness. So I think, I think it's very important that we all do what we can to help make Bristol just that bit better.
Afzal Shah, thank you for being so generous with your time this evening. I hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
From the bottom. on moving till I was back in your arms again. I'm guilty. I'm guilty. I'll be guilty all the rest of my. I try to do ever change around. You know how it is with me, baby. You know, but I just can't stand myself. It takes a whole lot of medicine.
Very nice indeed. Guilty, that's Els Bailey. You can see her perform live at the Bristol International Jazz and Blues Festival, which is on at the end of the month in various locations across the city, because that Cole Snoll is shot in him. Welcome back. It's The Politics Show. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling. But one thing that hasn't changed, feature of The Politics Show, is Martin Summers is here. Martin, we had Tim Kent and Afzal Shah in the studio for the last hour and a half or so. How did I do?
Well, I think what you were doing is very forensic questioning, basically. And councillors don't often get asked as many detailed, intelligent questions as you were giving them. But, of course, the audience for the show is both local, and there will be an interest in all of that. But also we've got an audience outside Bristol for whom, interestingly enough, some of the local stuff is actually, for them, it's like listening to the Archers. Because we get rid of the woman. There's a woman who's actually works in the European Commission in Brussels, and years ago she got back to us by email and said, I find the local stuff absolutely fascinating because it's just exactly the same here in Brussels. The issues are the same. And so, you know, in a way, the sort of close analysis of a local situation, lots of people who are not Bristolians can identify with the problems, especially if they're interested in politics and listen to this show.
Excellent. Well, that was especially for Ted, because Ted dropped me a line last week to say that it was tedious and self-indulgent. So thank you, Ted. I hope it was slightly better this week. In fact, why allow him to eat up time struggling for words? You are appalling. Well, thank you. I've not been called appalling
for a
while.
Feedback.
Exactly. Thank you for listening, Ted. I hope I've improved this week for you. Talking international, well, there's coronavirus, yeah. Obviously. And it's a problem, but it's not as much of a problem, I think, as the toilet roll hoarders would have you believe.
Well, I think the real problem with it, Billy, is that it's potentially going to pop the everything bubble in the stock markets.
Oh, so, it already has, yeah.
Well, indeed. And that, of course, that is, whether you get coronavirus or not, or whatever it turns into in terms of a pandemic, the potential to drag down the banking system down into the black hole is definitely there. The Chinese economy is virtually ground to a halt. And that was basically what was keeping the international economy functioning during the crisis, because they were able to sail through the crisis after 2008.
Well, it's
communist government, state-owned banking system. They, mm-hmm. they just turned on them. The
it's
money
the world's factory.
Yeah, that's right.
And of course, their employment legislation doesn't have such rigorous checks and balances, perhaps, as some of the European law employment.
Well, no, but you'll find that you know the ordinary people in China live rather better than the poorest third in India. It's a different setup. And don't forget, the modern capitalist China came about through the basically liquidation of the previous ruling class. I mean, they literally killed millions of people, mm-hmm. but they certainly didn't have to mess around paying them off once they were all dead.
Well, you know, there were millions who starved as well.
Oh, no, so they made massive mistakes, obviously. But, of course, what subsequently happened with the turn towards, what was talked about at the time as a more capitalist road in both China and outside China. But of course, now they're criticizing them because they're not as capitalist as they would like them to be. But nevertheless, the Chinese just say, well, that's our way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And of course, what they're copying is South Korea, Taiwan, the other Southeast Asian tigers, which do not have a free market philosophy. They've always had what the French would call a dirigiste philosophy towards the economy. So, you know, we are going to have big companies, but we're going to keep them on a tight rein. The government is going to have an industrial policy. We're planning, you know, in Japan, traditionally, they didn't have a 5-year plan, they had a 15-year plan.
Yes.
Yeah? That's how serious they are about planning.
Japan has also had a largely stagnant economy for the last 30 years.
Yeah, but that's because when the Ministry of International Trade and Industry was in charge, during the era when Japan was becoming number one, they wouldn't allow things like property bubbles. There's all sort of land taxes and stuff to prevent it. And, of course, the Americans were getting very annoyed because they were getting a massive trade deficit with the Japanese. And then they leaned on them very, very hard. Why don't you have a property bubble? We have them. It makes loads of people rich. Why don't you have a property bubble? So just before the Japanese economy collapsed, the area of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo was worth more than the whole of the state of California. Now, of course, that was pretty irrational, and mm-hmm. then it led to a crash. But, of course, the thing is, if they'd been allowed to carry on their traditional method, where they basically, I mean, the landlord classes in Japan weren't liquidated as they were in China, but they were definitely disciplined by the post-war Japanese government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, land reform, for example. The people who worked the land got the land. That was it. The landlord class were just wiped out in terms of land ownership. In China, they took the land off them and they killed them as well. So they really can't cause any more trouble.
But, to be fair, Japan did operate a largely feudal system for over 1,500 years.
That's why they ended up being bombed with nuclear weapons by the Americans and put in their place, you know. But, of course, there was a transformation. I mean, you know, after World War II, both Germany and Japan, quite wisely, were given a chance to rehabilitate themselves, which is absolutely right. After World War I, which was everybody's fault, the Germans were made to think that they were the only ones who were to blame and all the rest of it, which turned into a disastrous...
Second World War, exactly. Yeah. Talking of the end of the First World War, because we're around about commemoration time, it's 100 years since that all wrapped. Well, it's 102 years, actually, since all of that wrapped up. It's 100 years and change for universal suffrage if you were a woman of property.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's 100 years since the downfall of the Ottoman Empire. This, I think, is more pertinent to what we're talking about in the news, less and less. But we touched on the Sykes-Picot last week, the agreement for France and Britain, the victors in the First World War, to carve up the remnants of the Ottoman Empire as they chose to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Oil had just been discovered round about, it was into Crete, I think, in 1916 they discovered oil, which is Saddam Hussein's hometown, I believe, or is it Mosul? Mosul or Tikrit, one of those.
Tikrit.
It was open season. And of course, interestingly, and this is something that most British historians overlook, Churchill was involved in the discussions, as well as Allenby, who was trying to run things from Cairo when they took over Jerusalem, and T.E. Lawrence, as well as Gertrude Bell. Churchill never forgave the French for how they treated the Syrians in 1919 to 1925, 1928. And it is argued that that's what precipitated Churchill bombing the French fleet while still in port with all hands on deck in 1940.
All right. Well, I think in actual fact, Churchill was definitely in the imperialist camp. Basically, they stitched up with the French how to divide up the Middle East. There was a bit of a squabble about who was going to get what. But the whole thing about the Sykes-Picot agreement was a secret agreement. And, of course, when the Bolsheviks took power in Russia, they said, we're not going to do any more secret agreements. And they came out with all this. Is how everybody knew about it, because they had access to these secret agreements. So they said, this is what the capitalist imperialists do. We're not going to do it like that. Of course, in the real world, there are secret agreements and there are open agreements. Mm-hmm. But I don't think somebody like Churchill gave much thought to what was going to happen to the people of Syria. He probably wanted a bit of Syria for Britain, but then he didn't get it. But if the Syrians then rebel against the French, it's not because of course they did. Mm. There was a massive uprising and the French put it down.
Yes,
and
then, quite and then, very bloody.
And then they created the state of Lebanon, because Syria had been, you know, the Syrians drove them out. Ultimately, so all of this history going back to that era is still very live.
Well, it's now.
It's still going on now. I mean, the Putin and Erdogan met up yesterday in Moscow, and the ceasefire is now in place in Idlib.
And apparently it has held.
Yeah, but it won't hold for long. It's definitely a ceasefire, not a peace agreement. It's Erdogan is a bit of an adventurist, basically. And he's pushed ahead with what he's trying to do in Syria without even thinking through the consequences.
Adventurist is quite carefully chosen, because I have heard a number of other accusations levelled against him, amongst which crook and thug feature quite highly.
Yes, but I think the thing about people like Erdogan and Modi, who we were talking about earlier, is you can recognise that they are not the sort of people that you like very much, but you've also got to recognise that they represent certain political forces that have got to be dealt with one way or another. Yeah, the Justice and Development Party in Turkey is not a one party state, but they tended to dominate. They're losing their domination, and of course in the Kurdish areas they are totally rejected. So this whole question of who gets to vote in elections, where do you draw the border, and all the rest of it, that's still very powerful in Turkey and in Kurdistan, if you want to call it that.
And bringing it back to a UK context. If you're, for instance, the International Development Secretary or the International Trade Secretary, both of which are posts held by a notorious alleged bully, then you much prefer dealing with a strongman who can make a decision on the spot.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's an element of that, whatever, in any kind of political negotiation, isn't there? You know, you'd rather deal with somebody who can deliver rather than somebody who's very democratic in theory but hasn't got any support. I think you've got to, this is what international relations is about, isn't it? It's trying to marry together, you know, whatever ideals you may have with the reality of what you've actually got to do, because that's what you've got to do.
It's a bit sticky, though, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of claggy, the fact that, for instance, a lot of, and these are, to quote Stephen Williams, former junior minister and Liberal Democrat representative for Bristol or someplace, he said to me in this very studio, if Britain ceases trading with Saudi Arabia, for instance, what will happen to all of those highly paid engineering jobs at Rolls-Royce in North Bristol?
Well, what I would say to that is quite simple. If you start running your foreign policy on the basis of trying to provide make-work jobs for people, you've lost the plot.
Well, make-work jobs for people making weapons to drop
indeed. So, in other words, there's a moral issue about wasting Yemen, which is probably the worst tragedy on the planet today. Mm-hmm. British military personnel are out there as we speak, helping the Saudis to target things. There was special boat squadron guys who were wounded out there. There's been no debate in Parliament. What are they doing there? That's what's going on. Meanwhile, we're banging on about the evil Russians in Syria and all the rest of it.
Well, Dominic Raab is rather quiet about the whole thing, isn't he?
Who?
Dominic Raab. Yes, exactly.
Well, exactly. Well, Dominic Raab.
Or Dimnik, as they call him in his...
Well, I mean, the thing is that the British, because of Brexit, are now desperate for trade deals with Saudi Arabia, India, China. And when you're desperate for a trade deal, you don't start criticising human rights, do you? That's the bottom line. And that's where we've ended up through various incompetent bunglings and vicious manipulations.
Let's talk, Martin, about British credibility and trust. Because British negotiators and diplomats aren't above promising the earth and then moving the goalposts before the ink is even wet dry.
Well, they've always been done that. Perfidious Albion, which is originally a French idea, and of course the Irish have always regarded the British as untrustworthy interlocutors, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that they are. And of course the Americans as well. I mean, the Russians do not regard the West in general, the US and Britain in particular, as agreement ready. Because you do agreements with the Americans, like the Iranians did over the nuclear industry, and then they just rip it up when it suits them.
Yeah.
Now, you can do that. It's like a game of chess. You can do that. But then some say, well, we're not going to do any agreements with you. Because you don't. If we did an agreement with you, you're not going to stick to it, so we're not even going to bother. So, you know, you can do, there's all sorts of things you can do in politics, you know, including going to war, you know, whatever things you want to do. But there's a price to be paid for everything. And you can't just have what you want, whoever you are. You've got to work it.
I get the impression from a lot of the Brexit negotiations, and it's subtle because Barnier and Tusk and all of these people are seasoned diplomats.
Yes.
They just don't trust any of the British people they're dealing with.
No, they don't. And it's quite clear.
And they're,
They just don't regard them as serious, to be honest. They're rolling their eyes because you people just ain't serious.
Yeah.
We're not doing a deal with you on the basis of what you think you want that you've been talking to somebody in the pub about, and that's what's going to happen. And, of course, there's a lot of delusion about this in general in Britain. People think that if you vote for something, the government's got to deliver it, and if they don't, there's some problem. Whereas if you look at the history of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, written one of the first history books ever written, the main points he's making in that, because he was a conservative Athenian voter, was that the Democrats just get it wrong all the time. Just because you've got a load of people and they all want to do something, doesn't mean they're right.
Yes.
They can be wrong. And they quite frequently, like the Syracuse expedition, the Democrats in Athens voted, let's go and invade Sicily. And, of course, they got there and got wiped out. And, of course, that didn't do them any good. And they're better off not to do it. But, hey, if people have voted for it, they should get what they want, surely.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought Thucydides up, actually. But let's bring it to a current context. You mentioned Iran. Mm-hmm. The European Union is vacillating about how much of the nuclear discontinuation agreement they're prepared to stand behind. Trump has made his sentiments abundantly clear on that.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe appears to have secured a temporary release this week.
I didn't hear that.
Okay, interesting.
Is she still in Iran?
Yes.
All right, so they've released her from prison. She's still on the house.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the full detail is. I haven't dug down into it yet. But Iran seems to be significantly affected by coronavirus, and I'm wondering if that's a factor.
Well, I mean, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, you know, Soleimani used to head.
Yeah.
Their guy said, we suspect that this is a bio-warfare attack because it's mostly happening in China and to us. And they're having a very serious attack in Iran. 24 MPs, senior people, all these people suddenly going down with it. And they've got suspicious minds, especially since the Americans just assassinated their top general without any warning. And the British, who weren't warned about it, of course, we're talking about sovereignty. Nobody bothered to tell Boris or Dominic that the Americans were going to do that. And, of course, the Irish Guards are actually just north of Baghdad in a base. And, of course, if it comes to fighting, those guys are all going to be in prison or dead.
Yes.
You'd have thought that they might have told the British that they were going to try and assassinate Soleimani.
It should be pointed out the Irish Guards are a regiment in the British Household Cavalry. Yes,
well, the Household, not cavalry, but yes.
Yeah, it's not an Irish regiment.
No, but a lot of the guys in it are actually from Ireland.
Yes, you know, I'm aware of that. It's a bit of a mess, right? We're going to take a piece of music because I need to digest a little bit of this. And we really rushed through Northern Ireland last week. I want to revisit that. And I'd like to touch on Britain's post-Brexit situation. You brought the stock markets up a while ago.
Yeah.
And whatever you think of the lack of trustworthiness in Britain, I think it might be interesting to prophesize what may happen to the financial markets and indeed the financial services industry in this company after in this country after. Anyway, here's something that you'll recognize. Go, ABBA, all the way from Sweden. Money, money, money. It's a rich man's world. And it turns out it is. How much money do you think each cabinet member has in the bank?
Well, that's an interesting question because most of the Tories don't live on their salaries. They are basically business people who happen to do a bit of politics in their spare time. Mm. And that goes for people like Rees-Mogg and Cameron and Boris even. He's got plenty of money coming in that isn't to do with his job.
Oh, yeah, journalism money, you know, business interest money, yeah. Shareholding money.
People will be looking after his shares for him, etc., yeah.
Book sales money, probably some child support money. Who knows? I don't
know. So he's been stung for a bit of child support, hasn't he?
Anyway, so it is a rich man's world. And these are the rich men who are now the architects of Britain's policy for post-Brexit financial controls.
Mm.
I'm gravely concerned about this. There's already dozens of tax havens around the world. Jersey, Guernsey, St. Kitts and Nevis. All these wonderful places, Gibraltar, with a Union Jack on the flag. And there is very few checks and balances regarding fiscal responsibility or indeed taxation.
Well, all of these British tax havens are an illusion, really, because the money never leaves the City of London.
Hmm.
You say that it's the money's in the Cayman Islands or in the Channel Islands,
or
but
Belize.
It never goes there. Yeah, I mean, in the Channel Islands, you've got lots of retired finance people living there. But in the Cayman Islands, you can go and find there's nothing there. That song from the 80s, you know, offshore banking business, you know, Bermuda in the Bahamas. They're doing more than growing bananas as a tax dodge going on.
Mm.
But, of course, the British the City of London and these tax havens are all of a piece. And, of course, what the European leadership of the different European countries are worried about is that Britain is going to try and be basically a piratical parasite on the European single market. So they'll be sitting there undercutting wages and conditions in the rest of Europe and allowing people to, you know, squirrel money away in the British setup, which will not be available, for example, to a French president to pay for schools and hospitals.
Yeah, but essentially, Rishi Sunak and his cohort are designing legitimised international criminality, money laundering and scumbaggery.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you go back to, the financial crisis happened and it was very clear. People like Peter Galbraith, who's a US economist at the University of Austin, Texas, who's John Kenneth Galbraith's son, the famous economist, he said, this is basically criminal. And the way you've got to deal with it is you've got to put a load of people in prison and take their assets. That's what you've got to do. And of course, in the SNL crisis in the 1980s, 1,000 top executives, including Neil Bush, who was a minor Bush person, were sent to prison. And that's the only way to intimidate these kind of fraudsters, because fining them is worse than a joke, because they're actually making so much money on the scams they're in that fining is just a cost of doing business.
Well, we had Tim Kent and Afzal Shah in the studio for the first hour. They were both bemoaning the fact that central government have cut their central funding under George Osborne's austerity budgets by up to 60%.
Well, that's right. And then they've obviously that creates a great deal of difficulty for people who are trying to keep local services going.
Well,
doesn't
no, it's not that. It's the £400 billion they pumped into the banking system.
Oh, that's right.
Perpetuate this criminality.
Oh, yes. Well, if you're going to bail the banking system out, what was said at the time, and I remember it very well because this show just got going as all of that was happening. And everybody was coming in saying, we're going to have to do something about this banking system stuff. It's hopeless. So if we're going to bail them out, we're going to read them the Riot Act. We've got to rejig it completely.
Yeah.
But, of course, the problem is, as Milton Friedman pointed out years ago, you shouldn't bail out failing industries. Because if you do, it's not a one-off. They keep coming back for more.
Exactly.
Well, and of course, and then because you've bailed them out, they still exist. And because they still exist, they've got a massive lobby. And basically, they're holding you to ransom. And that's what's effectively happened. And that's a lot of things have flowed from that. But, of course, what's now going to happen probably is there's going to be a further crash, which will be bigger than the last one.
But they've had 12 years to fix the problem.
Yeah, but in that 12 years, what they've done is basically they've pleased – it's neither fish nor fowl. If you're going to follow a free market policy, you let the banks collapse.
Yes.
The consequences.
I agree, yes.
And if you're not going to follow a pre-market policy, you bail them out, but then you've got to tell them, we nationalise the banks.
Yeah.
Never mind nationalising British Rail or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You've nationalised the commanding heights of the economy.
Yeah.
Now, at that point, you ought to be in a position to tell them to do a few things. But, of course, the political power of the financial elites is so great that they just take the money and say, thanks very much, suckers, and then they carry on doing, they go straight back to the gaming tables. That's exactly what they did.
You know, not a single one of them served any time, apart from two traders.
That's right, but I was just saying, in the 1980s, a different era, 1,000 top executives in the US were sent to prison. And in the 30s, the Pecora Commission sent loads of people to prison. Prescott Bush was nearly sent to prison. He was eventually sent to prison by Roosevelt for trading with the enemy because he's basically heavily involved in the promotion of the Nazi Party. That's actually historical fact, you know. And they also tried to overthrow Roosevelt in a military coup, which was blocked by General Smedley Butler, who was the retired head of the U.S. Marine Corps, because they approached him to be the figurehead for their coup against Roosevelt. And he went back to Roosevelt and said, they've told me all about it, sir. What do you want me to do? Said, you know, lock them up, Smedley. Mm-hmm. That's all true stuff, historical stuff.
I was going to talk to you about Ireland, but actually I just can't be bothered opening that can of worms because there is no effective resolution in sight. I do have a media coverage question for you.
Okay.
We're getting a blow-by-blow account of who is likeliest to be the opposition candidate in the United States presidential election in November.
Yeah.
Surely there is more important stuff relevant politically, locally, in France, in Spain, in Ireland, in Italy, that we should be focusing our attention and our column inches to.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I mean, obviously, I, as you probably know, I work for Russia Today as a stringer. And, of course, people are not interested in Russian politics at all. Apart from, you know, Putin's an evil guy who eats babies, the actual intricacies of what goes on in Russia are lost because there's quite a complex political setup there with different parties and so on. But nobody's interested. And they've got nuclear weapons too. But, of course, the thing, you remember the song from the 80s by The Clash, "I'm So Bored With the USA"? Yeah. Well, that's just about how it is, isn't it?
Yes.
Because they insist that, look at us, and we all have to watch this wretched soap opera, because it does matter, because they're so powerful.
I still blame the British media for it, for their reportage and their insistence on making sure it's headlines all of the time. We're out of time, Martin. I've had good fun being in for the couple of weeks. Have you enjoyed being here?
I have, as always, and your style is a bit different to Tony's, but then that can be good.
Well, I have news. Ted's been in touch. He said it's been a much better show this week.
Well,
thank
you,
Ted. That's a marvel.
You passed your Ofsted. You're in an improvement.
Roma Widger is here next week, and we've got Steve Satan in a couple of weeks' time. Mohammed Makawi is up next with Leila Arabia. Have a great weekend, everybody. Tune in tomorrow morning. I'm going to be covering International Women's Day on the Saturday edition. It kicks off down at the Council House at 11, but for now, good night.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.